if I fall short, if I don't make the grade, if your expectations aren't met in me today, there's always tomorrow. Please don't give up on me. Oh, please don't give up on me. I know it's late.
Peter Gallagher made his name as a dramatic actor in films like Sex Lies and Videotapes and The Player. But when, as Sandy Cohen in the TV series The O.C., he sang Don't Give Up On Me to his wife, he was offered a contract with Epic Records, and he recorded his first CD, 7 Days in Memphis. Tomorrow night, he'll begin his first New York nightclub engagement called Songs and Stories at Feinstein's at the Regency Hotel, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to my show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard.
Didn't you start your show business career in musical theater in Hair in Greece on Broadway?
Right, exactly. I did the revival of Hair in 77, and just before it opened, I got offered a chance to go on the road with Greece and see the country and fly on my first airplane, and Tom O'Horgan, for some miraculous reason, let me out to do that, because it was Hair, and that was the vibe. And I spent a year and a half did 500 performances of Greece.
And then later, Skye Masterson in the revival of Guys and Dolls, the one that everybody remembers as Nathan Lane's, was it?
Right, Nathan Lane, Faith Prince, Josie DeGuzman.
So was it your dream when you were a kid to have a career on the stage and do musicals?
That was actually, a career on the stage was the only thing I dreamt of. And for the longest time, my high school drama teacher reassured us that a career like that would be completely impossible. He had never known anyone who'd gotten one. And so I approached the whole notion of it with a very heavy heart and never really imagining that I'd have the opportunity until, you know, I got to the point where I thought, well, whatever I do, I can't imagine doing anything else, so I'll pursue that.
But obviously you couldn't make a living just, or maybe you didn't want to make a living just as a singer or someone who appeared in musicals.
Well, you know, the thing that I noticed as a young man was that there were seemed to be fewer great roles for guys than there were for the women. And I felt like on Broadway then, if you spent your life on it, there was no guarantee that you'd ever really have a chance to, do all the things you'd imagined. And so I hope
that Carousel is revived every 3 years.
Exactly. So I didn't want to be pigeonholed. I loved acting, and I wanted to become better at it and more authentic. So I went in that direction of doing straight plays as well.
And rather ambitious. A Long Day's Journey and Tonight. Tom Stoppard's The Real Thing.
Right.
So you took that seriously. Had you really worked on your acting chops when you were young? Or did you think that you just, like so many people who appear in musicals, you can be nice, pleasant, kind of play yourself, and then sing the song?
No. I studied. In fact, I still study. I studied at the studio with teachers at the Actors Studio. I studied for over 20 years with Mira Rostova, who is just, I think, the greatest acting teacher in the world. And so I studied the Meisner technique with Esper. But it was being in contact for a long period of time with great writers' work, like O'Neill. We did that with Jack Lemmon for a year on the road and filmed it, and Stoppard, and that, I think, also, and sort of inform my point of view.
But your first film role was in Taylor Hackford's The Idolmaker, wasn't it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And that was, again, you were playing a singer.
Right. Of course, the irony of it is when the movie came out and people thought it was terrific, they said, my gosh, who did your singing? And you're dancing. I thought, oh, my gosh.
That was modeled on people like Fabian and Frankie Avalon.
Right. Uh-huh.
So you were getting roles because you could act and sing. And then people became aware of you probably really seriously when you were in Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape. When you were making it, did you imagine it would make the kind of sensation that it did? Because it was in a small independent film, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, even at that point in my career, and I certainly feel the same way about it, I'd been around long enough to realize that success in any way, shape, or form in this business is a miracle. And regardless of what you might think or imagine, there's so much that can go so wrong between the shooting that to assume that just because things are going well, it's going to be a hit is... But that having been said, when I read that script, I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever read. And when Steven said, I'd like you to do it, you know, and this particular part's not that well drawn, so I'd like you to contribute to it, you know, and the rehearsals and the way... It's like the same way we felt American Beauty. I remember Annette Bening and I leaving the set, and we're almost afraid to talk because we felt something really good happening, but understanding that it doesn't mean it'll translate into something people will end up going to see and enjoying.
Well, in both of those films, you played less than admirable men, and there was a feeling you were almost getting typecast in that kind of sleazy role, perhaps because you did it so well, or because that Hollywood mentality is, he was good in that, well, let's cast him in the same thing again and again and again until it fails.
Well, it's funny because in The Idolmaker, I remember somebody saying, yeah, you know, he was great in The Idolmaker, but we're concerned that his, you know, he's too New York and his English is not that great. And for years, because of Sex, Lies, and Videotape, I was seen as that, which if you're perceived as, you know, looking a certain way, you can either be the real bad guy or the hero. And if you're not going to be the hero, the bad guy's not a bad thing to be.
Well, it's obvious that you, I'm sure you've been in some bad films, but when I look over the list of films that you've been in, and a couple of Altmans. You did the TV film, Caine Mutiny, mm-hmm. Court Martial, but you also did Shortcuts and The Player. And you've been in American Beauty, Bob Roberts, Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle, While You Were Sleeping. I mean, were you just lucky, or do you choose your parts well?
Well, I've been lucky just by virtue of the fact that I'm working. But I'm careful about what I do because I think ultimately it's the only power you have as an actor is to say yes or to say no. And I would often choose roles based on things, not necessarily the part that I was being offered, but to be in the company of the people or to have a chance to participate in a story that might be well told. You know, it's sort of like when we were interviewing studio heads when we were getting ready to shoot The Player, you know, they'd say, how did Altman do it? How did he get so-and-so? I don't understand it. And I said, well, you know, it's a very powerful thing with actors. If there's the promise that things might turn out really well and you might do good work, that's money in the bank. You know, so.
And everybody wanted to work with Altman because they knew they'd get a good part.
And
they'd be with other good people.
And because Bob loved actors and didn't see them as an enemy of the process, but as an ally.
When you went back to the theater, you went to things like Noises Off, which was, again, an ensemble thing where everybody had a wonderful part. I remember that was one of the most hilarious productions I've ever seen on Broadway.
Oh, cool.
So, Lawyers became, after Sleazy's, Lawyers became your thing, or is that the same thing, the OC?
Well, you know, I mean, the OC was actually a wonderful departure because there was, again, that was a script, that pilot script, I read it, and I thought it was one of the best things I'd ever read. And I'd always wondered in one-hour dramas on television why they were so completely devoid of humor and dripping with what I called, you know, seriosity, which has the appearance of import and seriousness, but in fact is nothing, the furrowed brow, the notion that my thoughts are so much deeper than you could, you know, which I don't know any guys like that. So Sandy Cohen was a kind of a fresh departure, I think.
Described as the first Jewish heartthrobs on TV. And that's where this record comes from, because you serenaded your wife with the Solomon Burke soul classic, Don't Give Up on Me.
It was the first time, I think, in my career. When I started out as an actor, I thought, well, if you do good work, you know, you get more work. That never happened. It's every job you finish, the next one is like you're starting all over. And with that one, I sang this song. The guy who created the show, Josh Schwartz, saw me singing in a benefit in L.A., said, I got to have you sing on the show. And I said, no way. What do we want? This song stylings of Sandy Cohen? Only if it makes sense in the context of the show. And he came up with, you know, a great context and sang that song. And I got a call right out of the blue, and I got an offer from Epic and from Warner's, which probably says more about the state of the music business right now than, you know, my particular prowess. But it was one of those kind of extraordinary experiences. And I sang that sang that wonderful song by Dan Penn that the great Solomon Burke recorded. You know, it's a great song.
Well, a lot of soul-related songs here. You have a couple by Isaac Hayes, one that Sam and Dave recorded, When Something's Wrong with My Baby. You have a Leon Russell song. So obviously the guy whose first idol was Dean Martin has changed over the years. Dean Martin was something that you were able to do in the Hudsucker Proxy, wasn't it?
Yes, right. The character was Vic Tanetta, but it was clearly an homage to Dino. But, you know, it's funny. I also grew up in an age where on radio it was not the spectrum of genre and so on wasn't so narrow. You could hear, you could hear Otis Redding, and you could hear Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young, and you could hear Dino. Mm-hmm. You know, and you could flip around on that AM dial, and you could hear 111, and they all were great songs, at least the ones you remembered. And so, and the company, you know.
And then Freeform programming came in, and that was the whole idea. You juxtaposed weird things.
Right.
John Coltrane would be in the mix along with Dean Martin.
And it would trigger, you know, sort of subconscious connections or intuitive connections that were kind of exciting. And then that went out the window for demographics, you know, that.
Well, everything right. now has right. to be totally limited to a certain number of songs aimed at a kid who's between 18 and 18 and a half.
Right.
And, you're obviously aiming at something different here. Peter Gallagher, who will be performing at Feinstein's at the Regency Hotel. The songs that you have on the CD, or are you going to do other things?
I'm just going to do a couple of songs from the CD. I'll probably do Don't Give Up on Me and that Leon Russell song, and then just do a lot of Broadway and standards.
Well, don't...
And not even that meant, you know, and I'll be telling a lot of stories. It's pretty well balanced between the songs and the stories.
Don't Give Up on Me became a hit on iTunes as well, didn't it? That didn't hurt.
No. I didn't really follow it much. It
did from the TV thing.
Okay, I guess it did. And that was actually a different version. Our music director that I'll be playing with tomorrow night, Bob Thiel, produced that track for the show.
So how did you choose these songs? Randy Newman, for example, Lucinda Williams, are these favorites of yours? Or did A&R man say, I think these would work?
It was
well.
A common... The label wanted me to do all songs from the Stax era, sort of that Don't Give Up on Me flavor. And I said, if you want me to do all those songs, you should get Solomon Burke or Wilson Pickett. That just is too... I can't own those. I said, I love this Memphis sound. I said, if we could bring other songs and sort of reinterpret them in this with the horns and with Steve Cropper, I said, that would be exciting because a lot of the music from my generation was born in Memphis. And that would be exciting, but I'm not going to do. So I did a few of my favorites, like When Something's Wrong. I think When Something's Wrong with My Baby is one of the most beautiful songs ever written. And the sentiment is great. But, you know, the Lucinda Williams song, I think it was, you know, it works in that context. And the Randy Newman song was a favorite song of mine.
One of the greatest lyricists that ever lived,
absolutely,
I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
So is there going to be any Dean Martin in the show?
Yeah, I'm going to have to do a little. I'm not going to make a meal of it, but it will be as by way of a, I think, introduction to sort of suggest that in sixth grade when... you know, my friends were playing air guitar and celebrating the British invasion. I was doing Dean Martin impressions.
So, translating this into a nightclub act is really quite different. You don't have the horns and all of that. Who do you have accompanying you?
Well, I'm very excited. We've never played together before. We just met, all of us, for the first time. Bob Thiel has come out with me from L.A., I got my buddy Ted Baker, whom I haven't played with. He's on keyboard. He tours and has recorded with Steely Dan. He's in the pit at Lion King. He's a brilliant pianist. And we worked with Pete Townsend from The Who on a show that we were hoping to bring to Broadway called Psycho Derelict a few years ago now. And I've been wanting to work with him again since because we had a great time. And so I got Ted. So Ted's going to be there. And I've just gotten to know our rhythm section. Don Falzone, who's has been on the road for the last couple of years with Udo Lemperer, as a marvelous bass player, and Ben, and I'm not sure, I'll know it tonight, but I don't
want to
mispronounce
it. You have to introduce the members of the band.
I am, and I look forward to it. And Ben is kind of an extraordinary drummer, you know, jazz and rock and all these things. And a lot of these guys play different genres, which I like, you know, and it's what we did a version of this kind of in L.A. where I had Pete Thomas and Davey Farragher with Elvis Costello's the Impostors, and it was kind of exciting to hear them play Frank Lesser, you know, and to hopefully it won't be a complete train wreck. These guys are amazing players.
Now the O.C. just ended a 4-year run. Were you sorry to see it end?
Oh, yeah. I was sorry to see it end.
Because some people, you know, after a while, oh, enough of this every year.
Well, you know what, though? The great thing is it was my first real run in a television show, and thank God I'd done so many movies and done so many other things that I was, you know, had been around long enough to realize the grass isn't greener, and there's nothing greater than when a show is working. And I think it got a little rocky towards the end. It was, you know, probably time for it to move on, but... I loved playing Sandy Cohen. I loved being with those kids, and you know, it was a wonderful job, and it exposed me to a new audience, really, around the world.
And you'll be at Feinstein's until June 2nd.
Right.
This is your first cabaret engagement ever?
Ever.
This is something you told me before we went on the air that has been a dream for many years.
I just think first of all, after almost 4 years on the OC, it's great to do something live, because there's just nothing more powerful. And there's nothing, in my mind, there's nothing more powerful if you're in the storytelling business than singing a song and telling stories. And in that environment, I don't know why, but I've always been drawn to it. And I've never quite figured out how it could work other than going, and then I did, and then I did. But fortunately, Feinstein's called and gave me a deadline. And so I had to come up with something. And I'll be telling a lot of stories. I'll be telling stories about O'Toole, working with Peter O'Toole and
that must have been wild.
Oh, I loved him. He was one of the reasons I wanted to become an actor, and we got to work together, and he would come in the morning and say, Mr. Gallagher, how are you, sir?
Gallagher.
And I'd say, fine, thank you, Mr. O'Toole. How are you? And he'd say, gruesome.
We got this far without a cell phone going on today, but we're just
about... I got to remember not to do that in the show.
We are going to go out listening to you singing Lucinda Williams, Still I Long for Your Kiss. And Peter Gallagher is opening at Feinstein's, is it tomorrow night?
Tomorrow night, oh my gosh.
And it'll run through June 2nd, and then I assume at some point or other you'll take the show on the road.
Well, you know, one step, if I can get through tomorrow night, remember my words, and not fall off the stage, I will be the happiest man in the world.
You're going to do fine.
Well, from your lips. Thank you, Leonard. Still I long for your kiss. I know it's over, 'cause you told me so. I told